Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and you're listening to the all-new Monocle Culture Show. This is the first episode of our brand new arts programme that dives into the latest films, records, books, plays, TV shows and exhibitions. We'll aim to review them with a bit of context, maybe send ourselves off with a little extra reading, listening or viewing to do. Sometimes we'll concentrate on one exhibition, for example, by one artist. Sometimes we'll tick off a few different things to show that the job of a critic and of a reviews show is maybe more important and potentially nourishing now that we're all corks bobbing around in an ocean of information than maybe ever before. To find a form that accommodates the mess, that is the task of the artist now, said Samuel Beckett. Could he have been talking about the critic also? No, he hated them. Anyway, let's begin. This week we're heading to the cinema and taking Wes Anderson's new movie Isle of Dogs for a walk. We all know who Wes Anderson is, that American filmmaker with a penchant for charming, quirky stories and an eye for symmetry. His films are handsome, sharp and theatrical and told on sets dressed in bright pastel palettes that might just have inspired the Instagram age. Anderson works in live action and animation and has been nominated for 6 Oscars throughout his career. He's a roster of big names that he calls upon regularly to star in his features, including the Wilson brothers, Bill Murray, Angelica Houston, Jason Schwartzman, Edward Norton and Meryl Streep. You know his films, they consist of this. Bottle Rocket.
I really don't want to do this robbery, you know.
Man, neither do I.
Rushmore.
These are OR scrubs.
Oh, are they?
The Royal Tenenbaums.
Can't somebody be a jerk their whole life and try to repair the damage?
You probably don't even know my middle name.
The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Quiet out there tonight. Can you hear the jack whale singing?
Beautiful. The Darjeeling Limited.
You love me!
Yes, I do!
I love you too, but I'm gonna mace you in the face!
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
You really are fantastic.
I try.
Moonrise Kingdom.
Dear Suji, here's my plan.
Dear Sam, my answer is yes.
Dear Suji, one.
Dear Sam, where?
The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Take your hands off my lobby boy!
And now he's just released his latest film, Isle of Dogs.
You're Rex. You're King. You're Duke.
You're Boss.
I'm Chief. We're a pack of scary, indestructible alpha dogs.
Here is the blurb. In the near future, a fictional Japanese city called Megasaki is governed by the dog-hating but cat-loving Mayor Kobayashi. A sort of canine flu has broken out and dogs have been banished to Trash Island, left to scratch and sneeze and scavenge for scraps amidst the daily drops of garbage. Trash Island is ruled by gangs of dogs, such as the one we follow, led by Chief, an old stray mongrel who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, but whose pals are the formerly uptight house pets, pedigree dogs and gun dogs, those who fill the island is, of course, well below their station. This is when the voice of Jeff Goldblum, for example, always comes in handy. Now, the jeopardy is this. The mayor's young ward, Atari, believes his dog Spots has been banished to the island with the others and comes to rescue him but gets stranded himself and so pals up with the other dogs to find Spots and, well, we'll see. Maybe try and overthrow the whole damn Kobayashi rule of Megasaki itself.
The Japanese archipelago, 20 years in the future. Canine saturation has reached epidemic proportions. An outbreak of dog flu rips through the city of Megasaki. Mayor Kobayashi issues emergency orders, calling for a hasty quarantine. Trash Island becomes an exiled colony. The Isle of Dogs.
And joining me in the studio to discuss Isle of Dogs today on the Monocle Culture Show are the film critic for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Robey, and writer for the design site and magazine It's Nice That, Jenny Brewer. Welcome both to the programme.
Hi, thanks. Hey.
Thanks for being our guinea pigs on this brand new iteration of the Culture Show. We've got a robust subject, however, to discuss. Thanks for being here to talk about Isle of Dogs. Stop animation, it's Wes Anderson's second stop animation movie. Does it set him free, do you think? Does it set the Anderson imagination, a rare and noble thing, does it set it free or does it constrict it, I wonder, Tim?
I think he likes to be constricted in a way, and all of his films feel sort of quite sort of self-contained. I know they're in little worlds, little dollhouse worlds, basically. So I don't think he wants to be kind of roaming across continents, but he wants one particular kind of milieu to work really well. And here it does. And it is very different from his previous ones, I think. It does feel as though the Japanese setting has certainly unlocked a different area of his imagination, I would say.
Yeah, and it's such a specific universe. I know we're going to talk specifically, Jenny, about the design and about the kind of, as Tim says, the sort of stricture of that world. There is such depth of detail. A lot of people have said this is a film you're going to want to watch. It's going to do well in terms of DVD sales because there's going to be a lot of pausing and ruminating on certain
pausing.
Things.
Pausing, do you see what you did there?
A lot of pausing. Someone will put a woofing sound effect in there later on, Tim. Thanks very much indeed. It's 1-0 to Tim Robey, of course, by the way. We will be counting by the end of the show. Jenny, what do you think about that? How does that come across? Does it get in the way of the story at all, this level of detail?
I think it's something that you can tell that Wes Anderson maybe was, in a way, born to do stop motion. Yeah. It's like all of his films have had this element of control and visual exactness and the graphic quality and the colours, that when it comes to stop motion, he has that control and he can go to that level of detail, and it's incredible. And there's an exhibition of the sets on at the moment in London, and you can look at them up close, and there's just so much detail. It's visceral.
They're artistic artifacts in their own right, aren't
they? It's incredible, yeah. So I think that's set him free, and it's also just given him complete free rein to go crazy with as much control as he can.
There was an awful lot in Grand Budapest Hotel, I thought. Mm. But in this one, it's just like a huge smorgasbord of Japanese, if that's the right word for Japanese food. Maybe it's like
a
massive bento box full of like all these different little kind of compartments, and you know. But I relished all of that a lot, and I will really look forward to seeing it again for that reason. Yeah.
Yeah. There is so much detail to bore into. So let's talk about the story itself. When I left the screening theatre, I really enjoyed it, but it was a very slight story somehow, and I don't know whether there's some huge thing I'm missing or whether it is a kind of slightly whimsical thing. Of course, you can imbue it with dark overtones or undertones, whatever those tones might be. But I wonder whether this whole film was an analogy for something, whether it was, as Tim says, there is a doll's house world to a lot of Wes Anderson movies, whether this was quite a whimsical fairy tale like thing, often an analogy for something in its own right. But what about the weight of the story, I wonder?
Well, the thing that struck me is that it's, for him, surprisingly bleak. I mean, it's like, you know, a bunch of dogs trying to subsist on a rubbish heap and like tearing each other's ears off and stuff. From the word go, it's like, it's kind of not for young kids, that's for sure.
So, Jenny, a lot of Wes Anderson's regular actors and collaborators are checked and correct, standing in a straight line, saluting for Mr. Anderson in this movie as well. What about that? That comes as no surprise. We hear the voice of Jeff Goldblum, of Bill Murray, all the rest of it. Did you want to freshen that bag up, or is it kind of like we're on familiar turf and it feels good? It is an ensemble cast, I suppose.
I think, you can't go to Wes Anderson not have Bill Murray involved, it would be a crime.
It's the law.
But I thought it was quite fun that the Japanese actors brought in spoke Japanese and there was no subtitles. I thought that was quite a fun element. And I do think those voices, Jeff Goldblum, I mean, they add to the story. My favourite, even though she probably has about three lines, is Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
Absolutely hilarious.
So she plays a little pug called Oracle.
Yeah.
Who somehow managed to see into the future.
Her character is supposed to have visions, which means that she can basically understand what happens on the TV.
Yeah.
And I think the strength of this film is the characters, and that's where Wes Anderson's films like The Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore, the best ones, are about the characters and the frictions of has that family friction, like a lot of those films do. But as soon as you even see a character looking at the camera or blinking or their hair ruffling, you laugh.
And I think charming. It's particularly good when it's silent, actually, when it's playing out as a silent film and just spots his eyes at the beginning as he's a bit worried, he's about to be taken off and dumped on the island. That's the funniest stuff for me. And actually, the funniest credit that I noticed is Angelica Houston is credited. You neither hear nor see her. She's credited as Mute Poodle.
Yeah.
Which is great.
There's something about the power of the director when you can have Angelica Houston in in an animated film and not give her a voice, yes. but credit her for something.
Yeah.
So we talked about the style, maybe, a little bit, and the substance, whether or not there is kind of enough of it. And on that, maybe we can try and put this to rest. Did you feel that it was a huge analogy for something? We'll come on to cultural appropriation and mushroom clouds and all the rest of it. But did you feel that there was another story running alongside that we should be taking note of, or that it was kind of, despite being bleak, a little bit of a fairy story?
Well, it's sort of about despotism, I guess, is the main thing, because the Japanese mayor is a tyrant. He's presented as this kind of Orwellian, sinister kind
and
of
despot. And that's straight out of 1984,
it really
isn't
is,
it? The
yeah.
Kobayashi, the portrait, yeah. the big portrait, and the set. Mm. In fact, down at 180, the Strand is exactly that, isn't it? It's quite a sobering, because it's funny, but it's kind of pretty full on. One of the things that came out of some discussions about before we switched the microphones on was this idea of cultural appropriation, whether or not as a white director you can make a sort of Japanese inverted commas film or take the bits you like of that culture and get them quite right, but put them in the wrong context and all the rest of it. Tim, this was something that you flagged up because there were some reviews. I think Justin Chang and the LA Times talked about this as well. He might. But what's your point with this? Tell us what you mean.
I think it's a really complex one. You can't really accuse Wes Anderson of basic appropriation in this. It's incredibly complex and sophisticated appropriation if that's what he's doing. He's clearly a massive Japanophile and he's delved into so many different aspects of the culture and replicated things from pagoda architecture to the taiko drums on the soundtrack and kind of borrowed all of these things in this magpie way.
And the structure of the film, I believe, borrows bits of kind of from no theatre and from sort
absolutely,
of
yeah. There's
jet
so
Japanese
much
culture,
in there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think his vision of Japan to me is really enjoyable, but I think that it runs a little bit of a risk of being a bit other. And that's the point that Justin made very well and intelligent in his piece. And he singled out, as many people have, the character played by Greta Gerwig, who's this kind of student activist who kind of protests against the regime, but she's white. And it feels like there was an opportunity there to have
and
a
she
Japanese
seems also
character.
Like sort of she seems like she's been airlifted and dropped from Moonrise Kingdom.
She
she's
really
a kind
does,
of all-American
yeah.
50s kind of...
Yeah, and yeah. Although I like the idea that the actual Japanese characters aren't subtitled because they're just doing their own thing, I suspect that in Japan, the dogs are definitely subtitled for Japanese audiences.
yeah, yeah.
So there's still this slight othering going on with
them. Do you think they have? I bet you they'll have been dubbed.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly either way. It's like they're still being, you know, so for I guess this is very much a kind of Western criticism, but in not seeing those subtitles, we're kind of like, but what are they saying? I don't know. There's still something a little bit touristy about it, but I don't think it's as bad as the Darjeeling Limited was from that point of view, which I did think was really quite, kind of basic actually in its moves.
Yeah.
Whereas this is much more canny and sophisticated.
It's a funny thing. I always kind of find the director who. Let's focus on Wes Anderson on this film having a cherishing another culture and wanting to display your affinity with it. It's probably becoming less easy to do that innocently or display your innocence in that. And the difference between sort of ripping things off and making fun of it. But having said that, even in a screening audience, a lot of people laughed at things that I didn't think were very funny or that I thought Wes Anderson weren't meant to be funny bits of the film, but it was like Japanese people are like this and American people talk like this. And there was a bit of that, but that's kind of dependent upon the audience and what people in the audience find funny, whether or not it's the director. Where did you sit, Jenny, and what were your crowd like? Because there were quite a lot of screenings, I think, which were quite raucous. I think Tim saw it at the Berlin Film Festival at the premiere.
Yeah, I saw it.
We were stuck at the Ham Yard Hotel, damn it, and some nice cocktails.
Yeah, that's exactly where I saw it. And the crowd was laughing every couple of minutes, basically, just constant laughs, which actually I came away thinking, gosh, that was a lot funnier than Fantastic Mr. Fox, which was the first stop motion that Wes did. And as for the cultural appropriation, I came also away thinking this guy is obviously obsessed with Japan and all of its detail and its cultural history. I didn't think it was on the surface at all.
Okay, good. We've ticked that off because it is one of those things. It's becoming less easy to be from somewhere else and make a film about somewhere else, I suppose. Tim, we wanted to, part of this new format is fleshing out, is showing, like all good pupils at a maths exam showing our workings a bit. And I think as critics, I'd like people to know what you do, how you think, and how when you're writing a review, it's not something on the back of a fag packet as you run out of the cinema towards the bar. It is something that draws in all sorts of references. And for a film as deep in detail and reference as Isle of Dogs is, I know you wanted to talk about some of the films of Akira Kurosawa. Are you writing notes as you go, or is it just obvious it's in your memory as you're reviewing a film, as you're watching a film for the first time, you're going, oh, that bit was that and that bit was that, and I can kind of remember to piece it together. How does it work for you? How do you sit and review a film, especially in terms of these complex references?
Well, I think Wes Anderson really likes to flag up his cultural references. Yeah. It's a fun game for him to do. So in back in Tenenbaums,
there's a
for
klaxon,
instance.
Possibly.
Yeah, there's a klaxon. There were klaxons in Tenenbaums where you were like, oh, it's J.D. Salinger, I think. There's lots of J.D. Salinger in here, and you sort of think about it afterwards, and then you reread bits of Salinger or whatever, and you're like, oh, yes, of course. But for me, the Kurosawa stuff, it was especially one particular film, which is not most Kurosawa, the most famous ones are kind of samurai films, Seven Samurai, for instance, and that there are definitely moments which visually play with that, and you can sort of see the
Someone's
dogs.
Made a clip on YouTube of kind of trying to pair up bits that have sort of, yeah, and there's the Seven Samurai.
Yeah, you see the dogs kind of, their heads popping up on the above the horizon, like the samurai arriving into town and that kind of thing, and there's a big fight between two rival squads of dogs. There are other Kurosawa films which have a kind of quest in them to find someone, and that obviously we're copying that here as well a bit. But the one that's especially striking, I think, is this film called Dodezkaden, which he made in the 70s.
Dodezkaden. Dodezkaden.
Which is about a bunch of essentially homeless people in Japan living on a rubbish heap and sort of subsisting every day and trying to sort of scrabbling for survival.
This is so direct.
So direct. And it gave me the opportunity to
say,
Dodezkaden. I mean, that's what he's doing.
Tim's just quoting his own idea there. That's fine, because it was very good. you mentioned Dodezkaden, which was a film I hadn't heard of, but then I had seen bits of somehow. Mm-hmm. It must have been sort of, you know what it was like growing up, BBC Two late night in the 80s. These films always seemed to be on, maybe under the stewardship of Alex Cox or something, Moviedrome.
Yeah.
But that was kind of obvious and lovely. And I know you wanted, there was something called Stray Dog as well.
Yeah, there's one called Stray Dog too, which it has that kind of quest idea in it, where there's a journey to find this other character. And there's also his Shakespeare epics as well. Throne of Blood, the Macbeth one, has all this fog. And there are these sequences with them kind of walking through white fog, which seem to come from that. And then there's the King Lear one, Run, from 1985, which has these incredibly ornate kind of samurai suits. And you see that in the villain characters and the kind of the mayor.
Yeah.
And the colour coding for the mayor and all of areas of his palace and stuff like that feels very much like lifted from Ran as well. So, yeah, there's all sorts of bits and bobs that he's just kind of noticed and plucked. And,
yeah,
I mean, him and his design team have just gone to town on it.
And when you watch the film at the Berlin Film Festival, when you get home, you've made these notes. Do you go back to the old DVD collection, you get these things out, and you kind of double check them against the things? Because I like
Or
there
you
is
go
a
on YouTube
of...
and, you know, some, a lot of stuff's
just right
there.
Oh, I suppose that's right.
I mean,
okay.
The thing is, having to do a review straight away, you're going straight to the
press room. I thought of you getting the extendable ladder out, going through the attic, going through the Kurosawa, blowing the dust off the VHS.
I would have done that, you know, in the days before a lot of this stuff being on YouTube.
I'm a bit disappointed, Jenny, aren't you?
Yeah.
Kind of a bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
We just go on YouTube, Rob, it's all there. Okay. This is our show. This is where we show how good critics are and how much they deserve their posts. And it's like, no, I'll just go on YouTube.
Well, I mean, I'm in the press room having to do the review thing. Oh, God, what's the name? How do you spell that film? Dodezkaden. You just go straight on it, you know.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Studio Ghibli and some things that I know our listeners will be fans of and might be surprised we haven't mentioned yet. We're going to speak about that with Jenny in a second. But first, a few weeks ago, we did a programme about the design of this. We talked about the Oscars, we talked about set design and all sorts of things. And we spoke to Erica Dawn, who's the lead graphic designer on Isle of Dogs. And we asked, how did they come up with the ideas for this fantastical world? And how was working with Wes? This is Erica Dawn.
I think a lot of it starts with the images that we collect and that Wes collects. And after each prop, you have a little bit more of an idea of the look and feel of the film. So you start tailoring your references, mm-hmm. and it becomes tighter and tighter. But the process is finding maybe 10 images that you think are interesting or different or appropriate. And some of them might come from our experiences or examples from packaging from the 60s, or, you know, it could come from an Ozu film. There's a lot of references from cinema as well as real old posters and real old packaging. And from those 10 references, Wes will often select one that he sees something interesting in, or he'll select three. And that will become our brief in a way. That's our brief to start the design of the prop. And then once we have a first pass, we'll pass it back and forth with Wes directly. Sometimes the first graphic is the one, and sometimes it takes 25 revisions. And that's our process.
The film is set 20 years in the future in a kind of fictionalized Japanese city called Megasaki.
Yes.
Where there's been an outbreak of dog flu, or has there? Maybe it's just the mayor that wants to kind of exert his cat-loving control over this city. So there is something of pure whimsy about it, and obviously presumably an allegory which is less whimsical about control and government and casting people off to islands and all the rest of it. In terms of the design of that, it's very funny and it's very witty, and that is like the writing through a stick of rock. Every single element in it, in that film, from your graphic side, has got that kind of wit to it. Did you kind of realise at a point that it was pure instinct driving you on to know that this would work, this won't? You don't need to ask a question about that, and this thing works. How long did it take to essentially kind of get into the universe of The Isle of Dogs?
It wasn't immediate by any stretch. It did take a lot of time, because you don't start with guidelines, you don't start with a world, you sort of work backwards, where each one thing that you design becomes another piece of the puzzle, and the world becomes more and more real and more familiar. And what really helped is that Wes had a very, you know, he may not know what it looked like, but he had a very strong feeling of what looked right for the film or what didn't. So it was very difficult to veer off track, in a sense, because he did approve every single graphic, from a notebook on a desk to obviously the important things front and center, like letters and things that you see close-ups of, like newspaper spreads, but also everything else in the background that you may not even notice because it's blurry or too dark. Yeah. You will have seen it and you will have approved it.
That was Erica Dorn, lead graphic designer on Isle of Dogs. Jenny Brewer, we're going to talk to you as a design writer. Your eyes must have been trained on detail like this. It must be quite interesting, actually. We'll send you a link to that programme, because Erica was very good on how she put those things together. You noticed a couple of things. We mentioned Studio Ghibli and Japanese woodblock printing. Let's talk about Ghibli first.
Okay.
And you were very keen to talk about the use of food.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. Tell us about this.
Well, I have had the pleasure of going to the Studio Ghibli Museum in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And there, in that museum, there is an entire room dedicated to how Studio Ghibli films depict food. And it's amazing, the level of detail. And actually, when you think back, there is an obsession with it over the films, and it brings you to that place. They have this atmosphere of their films that they're unafraid to sort of pack the film with action, sit and watch someone eat this, and it's a bit gross, and it's not, you know, it's not pretty.
Got your noodles all ready? Be careful, it's really hot.
I suppose there's a very Japanese attitude to food, which is
you
might as well, and then they get hungry and they have to eat something, so we'll show that, and then the action will continue.
Yeah.
There's something odd about that for Western audiences, I suppose.
Right? Yeah, and I think that when I watched Isle of Dogs, it made me think about, especially there's a great scene where they are making sushi, and the audience in the screening were all kind of flinching a bit, because there's
this octopus,
and they chop off the end of it, and it's sort of wriggling around. Apparently it was and took a long time to make, because they had armatures within the actual fish that was being chopped up by the sushi chef, and to make this in stop motion. And to me, that is a reference to Ghibli in a way that they are dedicated to showing that food and making it a bit grotesque and very real, but taking quite a large section of the film, really, if you think about the amount of frames and seconds and that you're having to pack in, just to watch this.
There's
this
sort of there's a luxuriance about it as well, or is there? Because that's what I wonder whether it is simply showing that in order for this film to exist, in order for the, all the structures that go into this to, into place, all the people that go into making it, they need feeding. There is a structure. There is a ritual to the structure. There is a ritual to the making and feeding of the people that went to make this film, whether it's a piece of fiction or whether it is the actual film that you're seeing in front of your eyes, made by 450 people all over the world. I felt there was something kind of Japanese about that. Mm. Idea that everything comes back to a source and we shall celebrate that source as much as we broadcast the fairy tale kind of thing. Yeah. And I thought that film, that scene, thank God, is not on YouTube in any way whatsoever, that you will have to go to the movie theatre to see that. Because that was one of my favourite scenes.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. There was something about the luxuriance of the kind of what we might think of the pointlessness of it. Yeah. And so therefore, something of great beauty. Maybe.
Yeah, definitely. And then on the flip side, you have the when they first show you the what the dogs eat.
Yeah,
and it's absolutely disgusting, and it's got all wriggling maggots. And, but again, it's so real, and they just don't shy away from just showing that for a rather long time on the screen.
And, and they have to decide whether or not to fight about this.
And they just take one look at it and go, "Yeah, well, and they jump in. That's great."
And one of those great fights, the cloud of dust,
like an old Hanna-Barbera animation.
Yes, exactly. And they're great as well. We could talk about the fight scenes as well, which are very, very charming and very cartoonish and fabulous. But we're not. We're going to switch it up. We could go low. We're going high. Jenny's going to talk to us about woodblock art and sort of Japanese screen printing and those influences, which some of them are very obvious. Mm. And we see the wave, the Hokusai's wave, etc. Tell us what, because this was part of your review for It's Nice That, very interesting as well. Refresh our listeners who might not have read that yet about what you talked about in terms of the woodblock.
Well, that is the moment that perhaps anyone that... can recognise anything about Japanese woodblock printing will be the scene, the quick shot where they show the great wave and it's got the dogs in it, and it's sort of, that's probably the kind of most obvious homage to it, but then it's littered through the film. Particularly I enjoyed the so when the characters have TVs on in the background showing the news, the style that they are animated in is directly influenced by that kind of era of Japanese illustration.
There's something
and
very
printing.
2D about it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's laid at the back of a very 3D image in
exactly,
this film.
Exactly, yeah. Which is interesting because it could have easily been they're showing news footage on the TV of the same world, but it's not stop motion dogs on the screen and people on the screen. It's flat, kind of black and white, very traditional style illustration. And even when there's scenes stepping away from the TV animation, there's scenes like when the mayor is in a hot tub or something, and there's these sort of hand painted wallpapers in the background, or woodblock, they would have been woodblock printed, I guess, in the background of Mount Fuji. And that, again, going back to him obviously having a real love for Japanese aesthetic, that attention to detail.
So much detail in that as well. And that scene when he gets out of the hot tub as well, Mayor Kobayashi has that huge tattoo on his back, which, although people now recognise that people think maybe he's a Yakuza, you don't see how many fingers he's got on his hands. But then also, but the original thing of that was like it was as it was in the Knights of Europe, that actually it was an aristocratic thing to be tattooed, and it was part of being a shogun, I think, that you would have a, so you never know whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, or whether he's a natural ruler or whether he's a thug, or all of these things. So it's all quite, the use of illustration and detail is quite ambivalent as well. I quite like that sort of aspect of it as well.
Yeah.
Man, it's rich. I think we might have run out of time on the Isle of Dogs. We can always go back to the cinema, and it is one of those things. I think this will have a very rich and long life, probably on Blu-ray, I hope, rather than just regular DVD. Or obviously for Tim Robey, just YouTube. On YouTube. The poor old world. Jenny Brewer and Tim Robey, thank you very much for chewing the cud, for opening the garbage sack that's landed in front of you, and for spitting out the sardine bones. I'd also like to thank Jenny for coming in sakura in a sort of in a cherry blossom
accident. accidental completely.
Detailed shirt. Tim Robey is taking off his shirt and showing us his tattooed back, as well he might. Thank you both very much indeed. And if that's whet your appetites for some canine cinema, then Isle of Dogs is out in the UK now and will come out in the US this Friday. That brings us to the end of this week's show. Join us again at the same time next week when we'll be dissecting the new album by the country star Casey Musgraves. The Monocle Culture Show was produced by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.